Welcome to another episode of Fucan Conversation. I'm so excited, and actually my heart's really moved to be able to spend some time on this episode talking to Michael Raymond Dardar. He's also known as M. Michael T. Mayhart Dardar. He is a member of the United Houma Nation, which is in Louisiana in the United States. I know Michael as the tribal historian for the United Houma Nation, also a former member of the Tribal Council, and also consider him to be an elder, a good teacher, and a good friend. Michael, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. It's a pleasure to be here, Nick.
And where are you at right now? Are you in Raceland, Louisiana?
Yes, I'm in Raceland at home.
I know we talked a couple of weeks ago, and I briefly asked you about how things have been in Louisiana in terms of COVID-19, but I'm wondering how things have been for you and your family during this pandemic.
Well, like everybody else, you know, it's led to a lot of isolation. Thanksgiving just recently passed, and we did a much smaller version, just my wife and I and a couple of the grandkids and my daughter, as opposed to the entire family usually getting together for that particular holiday. But my wife Daisy's niece actually and is recently married, and her husband and their infant child came down with COVID right before Thanksgiving, so they had to be quarantined. So it's like everybody else, you're reacting to it being in your immediate vicinity.
Has it impacted, like elsewhere, the economy in Louisiana? And I'm thinking more in terms of the United Houma Nation or the Houma community and the local economy of trawling, or even protocols for if you happen to be from a family who's working on some of the oil rigs.
Yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag depending on what particular part of the economy you participate in. The commercial fishermen, it's kind of like my occupation as a marine mechanic, you know, working for just one company. I'm able to isolate myself. I do a lot of my work at the shop in Venice and those sorts of scenarios. And so I don't have a lot of interaction with people on a daily basis. And that's the case with the commercial fishermen. In other occupations, you know, like the guys in the oil field, I know that the oil industry has instituted a lot of protocols. It kind of touches on what I do because a couple of our boats work in it. So the guys that work offshore 14 and 7 or 14 and 14, they have to go through a testing protocol. They'll go to work, take a rapid test. Once they're cleared, go offshore either to a platform or on a boat, and the crew remains isolated as much as possible. And then when they get off, they're tested before they go home. So it's just the new normal.
You know, when I was introducing you, I got so excited. And then also because, you know, it's been a while since we've chatted, and then I get emotional because it's been a while since we've chatted, and starting in terms of where you're at and where you're living. But I've been following your work ever since I've known you. And one of the things that I love in terms of what you've been able to teach me is your sensibility as a poet. So you write poetry, and also your in-depth knowledge of history, both in terms of the local context in relation to your community, but also in several ways in which you comment on your own local context of history in relation to the wider political implications for the settler colonial government state called the United States. And then also internationally, like you've made a lot of, in your writings, connecting it to what's taking place elsewhere. I'm just wondering, I can see in your work that you have a love for poetry, but also a love for history and politics. And I'm wondering where is that passion, love for those areas and the kind of work that you do, and also the ways in which you seek to serve your community. Where did you first start taking that up prior to either becoming involved in the political side of your community, and then also now as a teacher in many ways to the next generation within your community?
It's been an interesting journey. I've always, as long as I can remember, been an avid reader. And I mean, you know the context of generationally with our tribe, you know, I'll be 59 in a month. I'm part of that first generation in the tribe that was actually able to attend public high school, public school, graduate high school. And so that was an emphasis of my parents. But once I graduated high school, I went to work. I really, you know, I gave some passing thought to college, but this just wasn't for me at the time. And so my education for the most part has been on my own. You know, that love of reading when I was a young child just continued throughout my life. And so recent conversation with my granddaughter, who's my oldest granddaughter, Skylar, who's at Nichols, you know, struggling writing a couple term papers. And my advice to her in helping her to be a better writer was to read more, because that's my experience. You know, my writing and my ways of communicating came out of that love of reading.
And what would you say kind of really provoked you in terms of what you've been reading to rethink or even make the kind of connections that you were experiencing in your daily life in Louisiana in relation to your poetry or your political writings?
Well, again, it's that journey. You know, I started off always being interested in history. You know, my dad was a World War II vet. And so I read about World War II and was an avid reader. And it kind of, it went through stages. And so after I got on the tribal council and got involved with tribal politics and indigenous issues and those sorts of things, you know, that led me to post-colonial, you know, just one particular aspect that led me to post-colonial studies and reading writers like Frantz Fanon. And then in reading The Wretch of the Earth, of course, the introduction to The Wretch of the Earth was written by Jean-Paul Sartre. And so reading that got me interested in his writings. And then his writings led me to an interest in existentialism. And that interest in existentialism led me to an acute interest in the writings of Friedrich Nietzsche. And so it's been that kind of journey where one thing led me to another. And then these different authors and thinkers enlightened me on what I was seeing from my perspective. And so my writings to me have always been like therapy. You know, it's an out for me. It's enabled me to articulate how I see the world from my particular indigenous perspective.
In terms of those thinkers and then others, because I know the works that I was able to review that you've published either in Estruma, A Homa Manifesto, or Dissident Voice, really kind of synthesize what some of those scholars have said in their works and your take on them, but really in relation to the context of your lived experiences as a member of the United Homa Nation in relation to the political context in the U.S. I was wondering, like, you know, if you don't mind me, I would love to read, and I should have asked you before if you were open to reading a couple of your poems, because they're beautifully written, and some of them are, you know, they speak in ways to your lived experience in the political context of the kind of histories and contemporary issues that you're taking up. In Estruma, A Homa Manifesto, you say, "Unfortunately, the avarice of industry is not affected by the tragedy of land loss or an ecosystem's destruction. To them, it's still a world of profit and gain. In 1998 alone, the mineral severance taxes for Lafourche and Terrebonne parishes, a large portion of which comes from the former Homa land base, produced $20 million for the state of Louisiana. For the Homa people, after generations of struggle, their reward is that 40% of their population lives below the poverty line. 40 years after being allowed to attend public school, over 40% still lack a high school education." I mean, you're referring to a specific moment in time. I don't know if those numbers have changed at all now that we're in 2020, or the politics around land in relation to federal recognition, the work that you see being done and on behalf of the community in relation to land in Louisiana.
No, it hasn't substantially changed. The players change to a degree, the politics, you know, because of redistricting and that sort of thing. When I wrote that at that particular time, our congressional district was contained the majority of Lafourche and Terrebonne, and now it's split up with by gerrymandering, but it's still substantially the same thing, and it's the reality for the Houma people, but it's the reality for every marginalized community, especially here in Louisiana, but I'm sure throughout the United States, around the world, it's these corporations that come in and make their fortune in these extraction industries do so without, you know, not only destroying the environment, but not substantially benefiting the people of the land who are affected by that destruction.
For listeners out there, they most likely won't be familiar with that history of extraction and the impacts it's had for the United Houma Nation. But I mean, I remember when I was down there and doing my doctoral work at Louisiana State University, and I was lucky enough to have these kind of conversations with you weekly. I mean, the oil industry, although it does provide the economy that several members are able to work within and provide for their families in some sort of way, the damage that it's done, I say damage politically into the environment, you outline that in your work, and it's something that's ongoing. I'm just wondering, in some of the work and what you've commented on the spill, the Deepwater Horizon BP spill that took place in 2010, and is the environment still trying to recover and heal from that spill, and is it still having lasting effects on the community?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Politically and economically, it's been, for the most part, put into the rearview mirror, but the environment has changed substantially. Unfortunately, the commercial fishing industry had been going downhill since before the Deepwater Horizon, and its demise continues post Deepwater Horizon. And that's, you know, the catch 22 is that the economy is substantially different now than it was when I was a young man. Most people that were dependent on the commercial fishing industry and the trapping industry and all those things that were vibrant when I was young are substantially reduced. And so you find the population dependent on the very industry that's responsible for destroying the environment and destroying their traditional occupations. And so it makes for peculiar politics in South Louisiana, like in a lot of rural areas in the country, where local population in support for the most part of pro-industry conservative political candidates, because they see that as their only livelihood.
In terms of informing the political candidates that are representing the communities that are down there?
Yeah, because, well, you know, it's been a long-term strategy for them. You know, I mentioned gerrymandering, and so what you have, like here where I live, is you have a congressional representative that whose home base is in Metairie, but because of gerrymandering and the way they've stretched the congressional district to take advantage of a conservative voting base, you're left without a voice, essentially. You know, I mean, you could write a letter to them and complain about the practices of the oil industry and about coastal erosion and all of those issues that are vital to the survival of the Houma community, but his voting record tells you that he's not going to listen to you, which is the case for the majority of the people who hold positions of authority in local and state government. I mean, you find support to a degree for various coastal restoration projects, but you won't find a lot of support for holding the industries responsible for the overall problem to begin with.
And is there still, I mean, when we talk about coastal restoration projects, that's still in response to the saltwater incursion and erosion of the marsh, right? The marsh grass.
Correct. They've made some limited progress in some areas, but there are other areas that, you know, you're familiar with, Ile Jean Charles, the Indian community down in Lower Terrebonne Parish is outside of all of the restoration efforts, so nothing substantially has been done to save it. And so there's been an effort to relocate the people from the island into a more sustainable community further up the bayou. But we've lost ground in areas like that.
And I think most people that have not traveled to Louisiana, and even if they have, because I think, several people, when they travel to Louisiana, they might head to New Orleans or Baton Rouge, but not necessarily to the southern, right, the southern limits of the Five Fingertips, and even if you're lucky enough to make it out to Venice. And I was wondering two things. One, I know you've been displaced from your home community and traditional place where you grew up down in Venice, in that area after Hurricane Katrina and the flooding that took place there. Do you still have that land? And do you go and visit? And also, the hurricane season this year, or even the storm season, how has that been in terms of its impact on different communities?
Well, on Venice, I still go down. The company I work for has a mechanic shop down there. So I go down there 2-3 days a week for the most part. And so I see the community all the time. Unfortunately, as the nature of community is people in place. And so the majority of the people are gone. I still see a few of them that live down there, but it's not home anymore. And the last few storms, there's been actually quite a few storms that have threatened Louisiana this year. There was some substantial damage in western Louisiana around Lake Charles and Cameron by one of them.
That was Laura? Was that Laura?
Yeah, I think it was Laura. There's been so many. Yeah. Honestly, there's been storms this year. I've lost track. Yeah. But there was one that just recently that impacted Plaquemines Parish, but it was mostly a wind event. A lot of power lines down, roof damage, and that sort of thing. But not a. It moved so fast, it wasn't a major flooding event.
So Hurricane Katrina, when I left to come take my job at the University of Ottawa, and that was 2 weeks before Hurricane Katrina hit. Like, so I, you know, being down there and then going back, this was a while ago, of course, I went back down, I think it was that November, and witnessing the devastation that had taken place. Most people that I know up here wouldn't understand necessarily the implications of the role the marsh grass plays in terms of the tidal surge. I mean, that must be a point of conversation when you're talking about coastal restoration, is the impact or the relationship between the marsh grass and diminishing the effects of tidal surges.
In a lot of ways, that made the difference in the two major experiences in my life. I was 7 years old and 69 when Camille hit Venice. It was it destroyed our home back then, but then there was a healthy marsh on the outside of the levees, which prevented the massive tidal surge that storm brought. That tidal surge destroyed sections of the Mississippi coast, which had no protection. In the lower tip of Plaquemines Parish, where I lived, we had substantial destruction, but it wasn't as catastrophic as it could have been. And so we ended up moving back, and my childhood continued there. Juxtapose that to 2005 when Katrina hit, and the effects of coastal erosion, that the marshlands that were so healthy back in 69 outside the levee systems were non-existent. And so the levee systems received the brunt of that 30-foot storm surge from Katrina, and they breached in several places, and we flooded in and destroyed the community. To an extent, the destruction added to the economic woes made it so that the community in Lower Plaquemines did not recover like it did in 69. And so, it, like I said, I go down there every week, and it's in a way it's sad, because it's kind of like a ghost town compared to what it used to be when I was a kid.
I mean, I don't know if that's a global, I can't say I don't know if it's a global phenomenon or not, just from what I've witnessed in at the other end in Northern Ontario. So thinking of where the watershed shifts and heads up north, even in my hometown, I mean, it was always the conversation around the logging mill, which is internationally owned by international corporations. And you know, people not returning to, you had mentioned like as the first generation to go to high school, and then there's the first generation to go to university and then not coming back to those places. And I would distinguish that between non-Indigenous settler Canadians or immigrant or newcomers that have that shift versus communities that are First Nations and living in relation to being on or off their reserves and up north. So there is a distinction there between the two. And I don't know what you've seen, because I haven't been there in a while to be with you all, but difference in generational disposition in terms of when I was there, and it seemed to me when I was there that, you know, an emphasis in terms of the government and focus was on revitalization of culture through educational programming, language, both French, because you being the largest Francophone Indigenous community in Louisiana, having relationships with the French before the Acadians got there. And then also in terms of the sense of community in relation to federal recognition. So I was just wondering what your perspectives in terms of with you down there at that point in time in the early 2000s and where you're at right now in terms of the community and your role within it.
It's kind of again, it's kind of a mixed bag. I'm not as intimately involved as I was back then. I've been off the tribal council now for a number of years. I still volunteer to help with different projects, but I definitely don't have any desire to go back to tribal politics. But I see there's a lot of positives. There's there is still that work on the Indigenous language. There's more of an emphasis now on the Aboriginal language than the Homo French dialect, but it's ongoing. Another generation has come along and now spearheading that effort. And with that younger generation comes more of expertise with technology. There's a lot of things online now. So I'm excited that they're doing those sorts of things. And that's able to reinforce some aspects of community via technology that we weren't able to work with back then. The other side of the coin, of course, is, you know, with the problems with coastal erosion, with the economic problems in the lower bayous, you see an exodus of families, not completely leaving the areas, but moving up from the lower bayou settlements. You see more trying to settle in the areas of Houma and Thibodaux in a more secure setting. And because of the changes in the economic base of the tribe, you see a lot of the college age youths who go on to obtain a college education moving into different industries, which is, which again has its good and bad points. It always goes back, you know, Brenda Daughter Robichaud, in her capacity in running the Indian education program in Lafourche Parish all those years, was always made it a strong emphasis on working with the young people and teaching them to what she called walk in two worlds, to strengthen their foundations in our culture and language and those things, but also to take advantage of the opportunities that we now have, that we have access to public education, to move on into new fields and new opportunities.
I mean, having said that, you made reference to Brenda. I know when I was there, I was so lucky to be able to learn from amazing leaders like Brenda and even your aunt, Ellen Gendre. You know, and maybe that speaks to one of the first books that you gave me that you wrote, called Women Chiefs and Crawfish Warriors, A Brief History of the Houma People. In that book, you kind of look at the history in terms of women leaders and provide an overview. And what were you trying to do or articulate in this specific book that you put together? And I must say, in English and French as well.
It was my first attempt, you know, back then, being on the tribal council and working with the federal recognition project. One of the things that always got me was there were people telling our story, but we, you know, for so long weren't afforded the opportunity to tell it ourselves. And not that I felt like I was any particularly gifted person in telling this story, but I had the opportunity to put it into writing. And so that I wanted to, as a Houma, to express our history, our culture, predominant role of women leaders in the tribe that I thought was an exceptional part of our culture and our political structure. I wanted to highlight, you know, and you mentioned my aunt, Helen Gindrat. She was always my hero. You know, she had been involved with tribal politics from the late 1960s on. And it was her retirement from the tribal council in the early 1990s that inspired me to join, to more or less take her place. I felt a kind of like a family obligation. And so I wanted to relay broadly the tribe's history, but specifically that pivotal role that women play in HOMA history and in the current HOMA political structure.
Well, and I still have the drawing that you did of Rosalie Courteau. It's in my office, still framed on the counter. And I think several things that you said that I'm just thinking of listeners here that they might not be aware of, the whole concept of federal recognition, that's one. And then two, the role that someone like Rosalie Courteau played in relation to troubling the whole process to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the United States government not to federally recognize you. And what are some of those implications there?
Well, federal recognition, you know, of course, is a subject you could spend hours talking about, but it was originally designed, the process was designed, from what I understand, back in the 1970s to deal with tribes and bands more specifically east of the Mississippi than west of the Mississippi, but it, of course, encompasses everyone, that were outside of the treaty processes of the past and didn't have a formal relationship with the United States government. And so it was a process for these groups to petition the government to establish a formal political relationship with the United States. It was billed at the time of its founding as a simple bureaucratic process. They established seven criteria. You were instructed on how to submit a petition to state how you met these criteria. And it was billed as, from what I understand initially, to be an 18 to 24 month process. And as we speak, the tribe began, the United Homa Nation began its research into putting that petition together probably around 1978. The formal petition went in, and I don't have the dates in front of me, but I want to say somewhere around 79 or 80. But that being said, here we are in 2020, and the process is not done yet. We still remain non-recognized and still are officially in the process of federal recognition.
That has implications, of course, for future land claims and then access to federal funding for different programs, right? Because you are recognized by the Louisiana government, but just not at the federal level.
Correct. Probably the biggest things that impacted in recent history has been, one, during Hurricane Katrina, when we as a tribe could not directly access emergency funds or assistance from FEMA because we weren't federally recognized. And prior to that, we were involved with a couple lawsuits dealing with historic burial sites that were unearthed by a couple industry groups around here and that we went to court with to stop and couldn't have any standing in court because we weren't a federally recognized tribe. So just in those two particular instances, federal recognition would have been very beneficial to the tribe, not to mention the, you know, the basic benefits from federal recognition, which is access to educational funds, housing funds, and Indian medical services.
In your book, Estruma, a HOMA manifesto, you outline several of grievances, is the appropriate term, or frustrations in relation to the history that you provide and the different political issues that you take up in terms of the intergenerational impacts of settler colonialism. But I had a question before, and I'm hoping that you can just elaborate a little bit about your thinking behind this collection of essays and poetry. But you dedicate the book to Papillon, a spirit of great inspiration. I was just wondering, I have, like, when I read that, I'm like, okay, is it talking about Papillon, the book in the prison, or is it in relation to some other Papillon?
The character that attempted to escape Devil's Island over and over again, in spite of all of the obstacles and all of the hardships, that spirit of never giving up, I thought was reflective of the Houma experience and the tenacity of the Houma people.
I mean, and then you articulate that in different ways in the work itself. So I was just wondering, in terms of that book, what was your thinking at that time? I know it came out in 2014, but I know that you had been working through these thoughts through and articulating them through writing for some time before that. You know, what was the inspiration and what were you hoping for readers to take away from this book?
You're right. The essays were kind of, the whole book project was really a I don't want to say haphazard in a negative way, but kind of a haphazard origin. I had written all these essays and poems, again, as more than anything, personal expressions of my particular indigenous view of the world around me. And it hadn't been long since I had, you know, got them all together, put them in a particular file, and was wondering what I was going to do with them. And I got contacted by Clint Bruce, at the time was working with Tetnair, the publishing house. And as you're aware of, their specialty is French language text, most of it dealing with Louisiana historically. And so they were thinking about putting something out that was more contemporary. And he sent me a letter, as you know, that's how long ago it was. It wasn't an email, it was an actual letter. He saying that they were what they were looking for and wondering if I had any that was that would fit that particular mold dealing with indigenous issues. And it was, you know, it was kind of, oh, well, yeah, it just so happened to have these essays. And that's how the project got started.
And how did the translation, because what I love about the book is, it's, again, both in French and English. So you have, like, on one page, the English, what you've written in English, and then on the other side, the French version of what you've said in English. So I imagine that was difficult going back and forth to try to put that together.
Well, Clint did the translation. He's also the one that did the translation of Women, Chiefs, and Crawfish Warriors. And probably more than, you know, I did the writing, but it's as much his project as mine. And he did an amazing job. You know, he felt like, and I think the work substantiates that his translation skills had gotten so much better since we had did Women, Chiefs, and Crawfish Warriors. So he was looking forward to doing it. But that, you know, it was a long process of going back and forth with you know, clarifications and ideas. We brought Steve Williams on, my cousin, in the end to do the artwork. And I'm really proud. It's a nice, it's gratifying, you know, on a personal level to have my work out there. But I think the work itself, it's a nice volume and encased in Steve's artwork. It really came out really nice.
You have in the chapter called Oft Repeated Lies, The Fallacy of Houma-Acadian Cultural Exchange. And I wanted to read one because I know you've spent quite a bit of time doing this and we've had conversations and it continues to inform the work that I do in the oral history or history education. But you say, it's under a section called A Final Observation. I'll just read part of it. But refuting negative stereotypes and erroneous impressions about the Houma and most other tribes put forth by historians and anthropologists can turn into a full-time occupation. I cannot leave the subject at hand, however, without one more observation from a Houma perspective. Not content with dismissing our language and genealogy, Mr. Stanton would also bring into question our material culture. In particular, he questions the traditional aspect of our Palmetto house building skills. And then you go on to quote what he had written. So I'm quoting him. Even the traditional thatch roof houses in much of the literature of the earlier part of the 20th century seem to be an adaptation of the common trapper's hut of the area, utilizing readily available materials. And so you go on to say, if I understand correctly, Mr. Stanton's observation, indigenous people of the area slept outside till the Europeans arrived with their European material technology to show us how to use the local plants, in this case, palmetto, or in French, l'antanier, to build ourselves a home. Of course, this is contrary to the oral and recorded histories of every tribe in the region, but what does that matter against the deductive reasoning skills of the anthropologist? What's your thoughts on that now that I read a passage out of your book?
In some ways, I was always hesitant to speak up. You know, I had a high school education at the time, you know, and even now, you know, I decided when I reached 50 that I wanted some new challenges and goals. So I found an online university and I managed to get an associate's degree in history, but it was more of a personal thing. It had nothing to do with a lot of this writing was done long before I got that degree. You know, there's a poem in there called the Trapper's Son. That's how I always saw myself. You know, I'm Mayhart's son. I'm just a home Indian, but you know, I had some semblance of common sense. I can read, and I know our history, and I know, you know, I know who we are, and I know what's been written, and I know what's been said. And so when I come across things like that, and Mr. Stanton's defense, I don't think he meant it as, you know, an attack on the tribe or any such thing. But I think, you know, there's a disconnect a lot of times between an academic trying to record some aspects of indigenous history or culture and the actual people themselves and their lived experience. And you know, and sometimes and in that particular passage, I probably got a little snarky, but you know, sometimes it gets under your skin.
I thought I didn't find that snarky. You were just pointing out the way in which it was positioned in relation to the way in which we can trouble those historical perspectives when you're not necessarily have the knowledge of the local context, right? I mean, it's the same. I remember when I was down there and we were having conversations around if we go back to federal recognition and one of the criteria of not being able to establish evidence of a community and the kind of evidence used against was, well, there's all these bayous separating these different communities on the fingertips. And it takes you like an hour or two to drive up the road and then cross this drawbridge and go across and back down. That any in a local context, if you took a pirogue and just went across the water, it took a lot less time.
Right.
So unless you lived that reality, you wouldn't understand how the community is connected by pirogue.
Correct. But unfortunately, that's one of the issues with the federal recognition effort. Beyond the politics and the economics that they're, you know, working against the tribe as far as land and industry and that sort of thing, just in the basic research part of it is you're working with a group of people appointed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs to investigate your claims of being an indigenous people, an indigenous nation, and they come at it from a perspective of having no experience with you, with the land, with other indigenous people. You know, they just have various degrees of academic credentials that allow them to take those positions and make claims or make assumptions about the validity of your history and your culture.
Yeah. It's as much the university and the accreditation for professionalism as kind of a, not kind of, but a settler colonial fort, giving these badges out to different scholars, if you will, whether they're anthropologists, historians, to provide evidence to the contrary of what your lived experience or histories might be.
Right. And that's, you know, and fortunately that's, I've come to understand that much, you know, this path, my joy for reading and this path that it's led me down. And so in that path, I discovered Edward Said and Orientalism. And reading that, then I understand it so much more now than I did then. And so that's, you know, that's been my education in finding these works and these authors and these thinkers that not only help me to better understand my own lived experiences, but in a lot of ways help me to better articulate it to other people.
Your political critique, or as a historian or former member of the tribal council, or even as a citizen of the United States, they're not, what I find in your readings, especially on Dissident Voice, are not partisan in terms of, you're very even in terms of your critiques, whether it's a Democratic Party that's in government, and that includes the president's office, or whether it's the Republican Party. And I know in your essay on inconsistencies in the narrative, and again, I just want to read a passage here to illustrate the kind of critique that you provide your readers, is that you say, while we can see many examples comparing the harshness of President Trump to the more gentle edges of a President Obama, and it is important not to lose sight of the fallout from so-called liberal policies. We decry the treatment of asylum seekers on our southern border, but we never seem to look back at events such as the Honduran coup d'etat that drove the populist president Zelaya from power, ushering in a repressive regime that has, to a great degree, spawned the Central American political diaspora, a coup supported by the Obama administration. Nor are we critical of the embrace of the doctrine of regime change by liberal governments, both in America and in Europe, which destabilized Libya and Syria, spawning a refugee crisis that bolstered the repressive policies of the likes of Boris Johnson, Donald Trump, and Viktor Orban. So again, here I see connections to the interpretations of the local politics that you're living, and then also the national politics in the United States to these interconnections with other places in the world.
It strikes me as obvious. You know, we've at least in America, it's like we've turned party politics into some sort of fan base. You know, it's our side and their side, and you know, let's not criticize the things we do. Let's only criticize the things they do. But there are truths out there, and you can't, at least I can't, see around them. Admittedly, Trump's an awful man. I don't know if he has any redeeming qualities whatsoever. And he's been a terrible leader. And he spawned some awful policies. But that being said, Barack Obama, because he was a much more personable person and a generally seemingly nicer guy, shouldn't stop us from criticizing the policies that were put in place under his administration that have had such traumatic effects around the world. And we don't talk, you know, from an environmental perspective, you know, you hear about the devastation in the Amazon and how it's increased under the administration of Bolsonaro. Nobody talks about the fact that there was a de facto political coup in Brazil while Obama was still president that deposed Dilma Rousseff and put in Temer, I think was the name of the man who replaced her, which paved the way for Bolsonaro. You know, those political machinations made possible the environmental devastation we're looking at right now. So let's not put blinders on, you know, let's look at the way things are, especially, you know, we're fixing to have a, you know, despite the best objections of Donald Trump, we're fixing to have a new administration here. I think, you know, you want to celebrate the fact that there's change on the horizon, but let's push to make sure it's positive change.
I mean, in your last essay published, and maybe I could be wrong on this one, and there's others, another one comes. But I mean, the last essay that you published on Dissident Voice was called Valuable, and you put valuable in question mark, where it's a short piece that kind of really pushes us as readers to question, what is it that we actually value in life? And again, I just take a moment here to read a short passage. You say, the current pandemic has served to highlight the disparity of this system of values in such stark terms that we are forced to face the harshness of a world economy that takes precedence over human life. While the poor have long realized it, now the majority are coming to terms with how much of their well-being has been given to the philosophy of gain. Now we see the real cost for putting a profit margin on such things as healthcare, housing, clean air, clean water, and education. We've constructed a consumer society that in the end consumes ourselves in its hunger for lucre.
Yeah, I think the inspiration for that particular essay was that short little article that briefly crossed my computer screen about this group of quote illegal miners in Southeast Asia that died in this mine collapse, and they were digging for jade, and it just, you know, my mind was flooded with, being a history nerd, was flooded with images of the silver mines in Potosi in Bolivia and the gold mines throughout California that spurred the indigenous genocide there. And we as a species decide this question, and that's why a valuable question mark, we decide this question of value, you know, is were those few little green stones worth the life of those men who died in that mine collapse, trying to, I'm sure, make enough money to feed themselves and their families? You know, we do this on a daily, on an hourly basis. You know, we decide as a species, as a civilization, what's valuable, and I think that's, I hope that's one of the byproducts of dealing with this COVID crisis, is we begin to question this value system that we've constructed, especially in the West, as this unthinking, uncaring, undefeated, you know, so far undefeatable virus has laid waste to political and economic systems without thought. And so let's, you know, while we're in the midst of this crisis, let's really give thought to what's, you know, and as all these things are taken away from us, you know, this freedom of movement and these bustling economies, and as this is all taken away by this virus, let's really give thought to what's the foundation of these things that we consider valuable.
And as you transition, or I say you transition, but as we transition over the next coming months, and nobody knows really where we're going to go or what's going to happen, whether that's with the introduction of the vaccine and who has access to it, but also for you in the United States, the transition to this new presidency, do you have a sense of that, the concept of what we value changing at all?
I don't know. You know, there's several streams working here. You know, you can't not see the Biden administration in some ways as an antidote for the Trump administration, you know, because the Trump administration has been so lawless and uncaring. But at the same time, understanding that the system as it is, this two-party system, for the most part, at least in my lifetime, has limited your real choices. But at the same time, you know, there's another generation of politics coming about. You know, there's the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there's the Katie Porters, there's this movement, admittedly small, but from the bottom up. This is bartenders and college professors and the like who are taking on the mantle of politics, as opposed to industry leaders and millionaires and corporate lawyers. And so I'm interested to see where that leads us.
Mm-hmm. I am too, Michael. I just wanted to thank you. There's so much more I'd like to ask you, and I'm looking forward to your next piece of thinking and writing coming out, whether that's on Dissident Voice or elsewhere. And I'd love to have you back on the podcast if you're willing to do so in the coming months, and have a follow-up conversation to see where we're at in terms of the transitioning out of the pandemic and how we're conceptualizing or living what we value.
Sure, anytime.
Great, thanks.